Welcome to Mental Health Monday. My name is Mick Coyle, coming up on the programme this week.
I got to the point where I was really severe with the depression. I could go to work, but when I got home, I had really dark thoughts, like suicidal thoughts.
If you do think about it too much, you realise that football actually isn't that great. And no. There's a lot wrong with the game away from what I would call the social aspect of football.
I remember a friend telling me actually who'd lost his brother. The hard bit isn't now, straight after your dad's died, because people will be around you and looking after you and things like that. As time goes by, people forget.
And I'll be reminding you how you can make connections with mental health organisations within your community. It's Mental Health Monday.
The home of the UK's conversation about mental health. Welcome to Mental Health Monday. Great to have you with us. Once again, really great conversation on the way this week, which will look at the issue of grief. It'll look at depression. It'll also look at suicidal thoughts, but told from the point of view of someone who's written a new book about one of his real passion projects, football. Now, although this is a book about football, this is not going to be necessarily a conversation about football. And let me explain a little bit about that, because often on the programme we talk about people finding their way through a particularly difficult time in their lives, and that might be through grief or depressive thoughts or suicidal thoughts. And for some people that can be a hobby, a pastime, an activity, picking up a new skill. And it's really interesting that Chris Roberts, the author of this new book, used writing as his way through a particularly difficult time in his life. And he explains in the conversation what those circumstances were. He's chosen to write a book called Football is Greater Than Anything. Or, as you'll see it on the front cover, football, and then the is greater than symbol, you know, the little arrow, anything. And it's an exploration of aspects of the game which maybe should raise more questions than they do. It's interesting that people find many different ways through their difficult times, and they find different skills, they find different ways of shutting out some of the noise around them. And the thing that really strikes me about this book is the amount of research and effort that's gone into referencing various different things from within the game, from other writers, from quotes from famous people that really go to show the commitment to the cause. But at the same time, this is very much a mental health conversation, and I want to make that absolutely clear that if you're not interested in football, this conversation is still going to very much resonate with you, because it's about how we see our own experiences in other aspects of our own lives and how we can hopefully use those experiences to recognize some things within ourselves. And I hope that that really comes through from the conversation today with Chris Roberts. Now, Chris is really open and honest about his own journey, and we caught up on this week's episode to talk about why he started writing the book and his experience in putting pen to paper.
So basically, I've been suffering from depression now for quite a long period of time. And I think one of the things when you do have depression is you struggle. The times I felt like I was struggling quite a lot was when I had that downtime. When I'm in work and you're busy and things like that, your mind's occupied. But when I was left alone, I have two small children. When they go to bed, I was sat around thinking, oh, it's when them dark thoughts start coming into your mind, really, when you're not that occupied. And to be fair, I didn't think I would ever write a book. A lot of people do different things to improve their mental health, going to the gym and things like that, which is obviously really positive, going on walks. And I did try things like that, and it definitely works for a lot of people. But I think because of I'm a school teacher, so I'm very tired at the end of the day, I had that low motivation. But basically, how I come to write a book was it was just by pure chance, really. A friend of mine in work was writing a book, sent over a draft of a chapter of his book, and it had in it missing references from the book. So what I started doing just by pure chance is going on my phone and on my laptop trying to find these references for him. So searching through different websites, and I like reading football books anyway. And I'm starting searching through them. I'm like, I'm seeing this somewhere before. And before I knew it, I'd spent like 2 hours, 3 hours searching for two references for them. And it just stuck in my mind. I was like, wow, like I've just spent 2 hours there, like thinking about nothing else but finding this for this book. And I thought, do you know what? This could be like something I could do. Do you know what I mean? I'd never ever thought about writing a book before. And I thought this could be something. So I spoke to him and I said, how easy is it like to do? And he said, it's not easy, by the way. I'm not saying it is easy, but he said, in terms of like just getting it down on paper. He said, like, why don't you have a go at it? Like, it doesn't have to be published. You could just write it for enjoyment. And that's what I started to do. Basically, I started to write this book, and it gave me that time away from them dark thoughts, basically that free time to just like focus on something. And I think with mental health and depression, you've got to focus yourself on something, haven't you? Like maybe learning a new skill or going out and being active. And the book just gave me that, like, it just gave me a freedom away from my brain, basically. I know that sounds crazy, but like, it's like a constant battle inside of my head every day. And when I was writing the book, it was like that just closed off and I was just free to just focus on something, which was amazing for me. And the book has been like a bit of a savior for me, really, just to have that downtime, really.
I was going to say, if you didn't have that conversation and you hadn't have found that as an opportunity or explored that opportunity, what do you think life would have been like if you hadn't have started writing this book?
Well, when I started writing the book, I just started counselling at Sean's Place, which is a service in Bootle in Liverpool, which I'm pretty sure you might have plugged before, hopefully, on the podcast. And counselling is obviously, I got to the point where I was really severe with the depression. I could go to work and things like that, but when I got home, I had really dark thoughts, like suicidal thoughts quite a lot of the time, and just really down on myself. And it obviously affects your family life, and it was them who it was affecting most. And that's why I realised I needed to get some help and go to Sean's Place, because I would have just carried on just trying to fight these demons in my head, I think, by myself, because I think there's a big stigma around it. And obviously it's getting a lot better now, like people like podcasts like this and other podcasts, and it's getting spread around on social media, I think, as well, like to actually speak out and talk. And I wasn't doing that, to be fair. And I had my partner like literally saying to me, come on, you need to go and get help now, I can't help you, do you know what I mean? And it was affecting everything really in my life. And if I didn't find the book, it would have been, obviously I still would have been going for the counselling, but the counselling just gives you a certain amount of help, doesn't it? You need to go and actually do stuff outside of the counselling and the therapy that you're receiving. And it was honestly a lifesaver, I think. And I've finished the book now, and I spend a lot of my time like trying to spread the message of the book and coming on podcasts and things. But it's a slight concern for me in my head now, because like obviously I do have a little bit of downtime in the night time, and I'm feeling a little bit down and things like that again. So it's finding something to obviously occupy my mind. And I've started going to the gym a little bit, but it's not as enjoyable as it was writing the book, I'm not going to lie.
A lot more physical effort maybe, but I'm sure that the mental effort required to write a book is really huge, because there's so much detail and research that's gone into it. And we'll talk about the sort of content around the book, because I think that in and of itself is really, really fascinating. I also think it's interesting that some people will find different ways of, alongside counselling, to occupy their mind or give themselves, explore a new skill. And for some it's knitting, for some it's, you know, exercise. I think you're the first person I spoke to who's actually used the thing of indulging yourself and your time in writing a book as being that thing as well. So I think that's really, really interesting too. Can I ask you about the family situation you found yourself in terms of the death of a parent, of course, which can be a monumental sort of thing that can happen in anyone's life. But you mentioned it right at the start of the book, which gives me a sense that that's almost a starting point maybe from where you've been at over these last sort of last months, if you like.
Yeah, so I lost my dad during COVID, unfortunately, and the circumstances around his death, obviously, it was during the second wave, I can't even remember the name of it now, but it was very difficult because he was stuck in the hospital by himself. He couldn't have any family around him, and my dad was a very, I think it's like what you'd say about men in general, and this is women as well with mental health, like he was putting on a brave face, basically. He was trying to show to us that there was nothing wrong with him. He was fine. So he wouldn't let us ring him or things like that. And because he did, I think obviously he knew how ill he was, really, and he didn't want us to hear it on the phone and things like that. And eventually he got put in a coma. And then the only time we were able to see him was when they were actually turning off his life support machines and things like that. And a lot of it is obviously really upsetting for me seeing my dad like that as well, but it was obviously being on them COVID wards was just horrendous, witnessing other people, because the layout of it meant that you actually saw people who were still alive, but just on ventilators. There was people who were awake, and it really hurt me just thinking, oh my God, my dad's been on this ward for like 2 weeks and he's seen people coming through, seeing their family members die. And I was thinking it must have been like so scary for him. And that's what it is. My dad was always there for me, do you know what I mean? And this isn't the first time I've had loss in my life. And the last time I had a really severe like bout of depression, he was the person to bring it out of me, it to like help me get out of that. And maybe I should have went and got therapy then, but I tried to like obviously heal myself really. And I did, I found myself getting out of it and things like that. And that was due to the loss of a baby that my partner was having. She had a miscarriage at 12 weeks. And unfortunately, on the same day, a close family friend of ours was stabbed and killed in town. So that two close deaths right next to each other was just really quite difficult to deal with, really. And I think people just say, don't the grief just goes over time, do you know what I mean? And I felt it wasn't really going over time. And at that point, that was the first time I'd ever contemplated actually committing suicide. And I planned that out and things. I don't write this in the book, but I'm happy to speak about it because I think it's important, because like obviously some other people might be going through these dark thoughts. And I went around and seeing quite a lot of my close friends and family. And that day I planned to commit suicide. And the last person I spoke to was actually my dad. And he sensed something, do you know what I mean? He knew me better than anybody. He was my best friend and he was more than a dad to me, do you know what I mean? And he sensed something was up and he started asking me questions like, what's up with you and all that. And I ended up breaking down and admitting to him what I was planning to do. And fortunately, that saved me that day, do you know what I mean? And so to then lose him, I felt like he'd been the thing that had just been holding this mental health together, I think, for me, really. And then it just broke apart basically when he died. And it's just been a bit of a struggle. And the book is obviously about football, and he's the person who gave me that love for football. And that's why I do start by talking about my love for football, but then start basically picking apart how football isn't something that should really be loved as much as maybe we all do.
Yeah, it's so interesting that. Thanks for being so honest about that sort of journey as well, because you've obviously been through some really sort of traumatic experiences. Sort of from a, there might be like a typical lad response about like what's the most important things in your life, and the, you know, a typical response might be that like number one, the footy comes first, and then it's the missus, and then it's the footy, kids, missus in that order, or whatever the phrase is that sometimes people use. It's actually interesting to hear that when you go through the experience that you've had, that you realise the priorities and the order in which they come, that the importance of family, the importance of looking after yourself is so important as well. And then the footy is an after thing, something which if you can enjoy, then great. But this is where we come into the content of the book. There's so much about the game, which I think is interesting to analyze in the way that you've done it, because if you do think about it too much, you realize that football actually isn't that great. And
No.
there's a lot wrong with the game away from what I would call the sort of the social aspect of football. Now, I think putting aside everything about billionaire owners and all that kind of stuff, I think the social aspect of going and enjoying a community activity with friends, with an element of risk to it, you win, you lose, or whatever, is a really, really good thing to do, regardless of who you're playing, regardless of the level that you're at, and regardless of really what's at stake. That I actually people coming together within their community into one space and supporting and championing, I think, is a really positive thing. Your book looks at some of those other elements to it, which is much more around the investment, the darker side of the beautiful game, if you like, which is why it's interesting. And I wondered how much were you writing the book, or how much were you into the research before you thought, oh, actually, all the stuff I'm finding here is actually quite negative, or the things that I'm finding an interest in are those sort of more negative aspects of the game.
Writing the book, obviously, I think lots of people do know that deep down there is obviously dark sides of football, especially with the greed in terms of football. So what one part of the book is about greed, but I just want to start out by saying I still do love football. I love it. My partner, I'll tell you now, I watch anything on the telly as long as it's football. So I'm still obsessed by football, but yeah, it has moved down the pecking order in terms of family, friends, and obviously important stuff in life. But yeah, it is. When I was writing it, you do just keep thinking, oh, I'm writing this in a negative point of view and things like that. But what I was trying to do, especially with the start of the book, with the win at all costs bit, is I was trying to show to people that we make out of footballers are like these former superheroes, really. And to be fair, like your idols aren't you? Like if I was to meet, I say, Mo Salah in the middle of the street now, I'd probably get really nervous and giddy and be like, can I get a picture? And to be fair, I've never really been one like that. I probably wouldn't even ask him for a picture because I'd be that embarrassed. But these players are suffering from mental health as well. I think that's what I was trying to do in the first part of the book, really look at how footballers' mental health is affected by this need to win at all costs, basically, is the first section of the book, looking at that. And it's really like bad, like, you know, some of the things these players put themselves through. And we don't really think about that because we put them as like these, they're like celebrities, aren't they? They are like these superhumans because obviously we'd all dream to be a footballer when we're younger, but the stuff they have to put themselves through in terms of, like, I look at injuries, for example, like playing through injuries is just like crazy, and that affects their mental health, obviously. And then I go into like the aspect of like taking drugs to be better than others, and taking drugs obviously to deal with the mental health issues, so like recreational drugs, moving away from the performance enhancing drugs. So that's what it started. I didn't really mean it to be like that. I was more like the book was going to just look at the dark side of football, but then I started thinking, I'm writing this book about my mental health, I can link this to mental health because these footballers are going through this. It's not just normal people in society. I'm not saying they're any different to us, by the way. They are just a normal human being as well. But they're suffering from this as well. And I've got a statistic that 1 in 5 players questioned by the PFA and all the English Football League said they suffered from some form of anxiety or depression. So that just shows you, like, 20% of players saying that just shows you that it's rife in football as well. As in society, really.
I think sometimes we get those stats, don't we, around, oh, it's 1 in 3 people or it's 1 in 4 people, and it's kind of easy to brush because you think of in society. But actually, I always think, right, well, that's 1 in 3, 1 in 4 in a classroom. That's 1 in 3, 1 in 4 in a dressing room. That's 1 in 3, 1 in 4 police officers out on the street. 1 in 3, and I think when you start thinking about it in those terms, you start to think, hang on a minute. What's going on here? I think it's always interesting. You mentioned your sort of passion for football books as well. Sometimes when stuff happens in football or in life, sport in general, where you're thinking, what's going on there? Or like, why has that happened? Or why is that player not played? Or why is he played so badly? Or why has the club not achieved anything? You read like the autobiography like 15 years later and they'll go, oh, that night this happened or that happened. Or, you know, they had an alcohol addiction or they had a painkiller addiction, all these, and then suddenly you go, oh, that makes sense. No wonder our team was never winning the league, or no wonder we didn't do anything, because all of these things. I think those things around when people are honest about those situations, everything seems to make a lot more sense. And if you're able to view these situations in the round, if you like, as this is an experience of human beings, they tend to make a lot more sense rather than going, why didn't we win? We should have won and we didn't win, and now I'm disappointed.
Well, yeah, you see that, don't you? And I think what I listen to now in my own spare time is a lot of podcasts, and that's taken over a little bit, the reading of autobiographies now, because you can get a footballer on a podcast, for example, and they'll tell you about the whole career in an hour and a half, and it is much easier to do than read a whole book about it. And they're a lot more honest. Like, I've been honest with you today about what went on in my life, but they're a lot more honest. And some of the stuff these players go through is, like, horrendous, you know what I mean? And I've started, at the start of the book, I actually talk about, I think, probably the best book I've ever read, actually, is a book about Robert Enke, who was a German footballer. He was going to be the German national goalkeeper in the World Cup. He suffered from depression his whole life, basically caused by the pressure of playing for Barcelona was where it really started, and the fans turned on him, the manager didn't want him and things like that. And he had that depression his whole life, and people thought, oh, he's happy, he's getting through it. And then one day he just decided to go and drive in front of a train and killed himself, literally a couple of months before the World Cup. And it looks into like private notes that he's wrote, and it's his close friend who writes it, who's a journalist. And it's a brilliant book, but obviously it's a sad ending. And I think that just resonated with me, really. You know, when I was going through my own struggles, I read that a couple of times and I thought, like, he could go through patches of being okay, but then not okay. And it's just, it is depression. It's just, obviously, it's up and downs, isn't it, really? And mental health is up and downs, really, depending on what you suffer from. And it just really stuck with me, really. And that's why I started the book with that. And also mentioning Alison Becker, you know, the Liverpool goalkeeper. Like you said, when I lost my dad, the football really took a back, went on the back burner, really. Obviously, you couldn't go the match in a season ticket hold, but you couldn't go the match. And I just, it wasn't really bothering me. Like if Liverpool get beat, it will bother me usually. But it wasn't bothering me. Obviously, I was just in that, I was just zoned out. And I wasn't really enjoying when they were winning. I wasn't really bothered when they were losing. And then I think his dad died as well, like about a month after my dad. And I think it was about a month after that. So I've went 2 months of like just watching football, not being bothered about it. And I don't know if you can remember, he scored the goal in the last minute, Alisson, and he broke down in tears and I broke down in tears. And by the way, I've been to watch Liverpool in Champions League finals and things like that. I've never really cried before at a football match. It doesn't bring out that emotion in me. Obviously, I'm happy, but I don't cry to that extent. Even if they lose, I don't cry, but I just found myself in tears crying because I could see the pain in his face and knowing he's going through the same thing as me, really. And he's had the strength to do that. And it gave me a little bit of a kick to think, because I was moping around, I need to start trying to do something here a little bit. And I started being a bit, going on walks and things, but still, obviously, I wasn't scoring a goal in the Premier League.
Yeah. So for people who don't follow football, by the way, so Alison Becker is a goalkeeper, so wouldn't normally be the one who'd be expected to score a goal. But Liverpool were playing probably the worst team in the league, but couldn't get anything past them. And in the last minute, the goalkeeper goes, you know what, I'll have a go, and steps up, which is why it creates this sort of iconic moment. If you type it into any social media, you'll find little links where people put like the Titanic music behind it, yeah, and all that kind of stuff, because it's this epic moment. But of course, these things matter so much more to different people for different reasons, which we don't know. You know, and if you had been sort of caught on camera at that point and that had appeared on social media, people would have gone, oh, look at this Liverpool fan crying his eyes out over. But actually, this, when you go, well, here's the reason and here's the story, it makes so much sense, and then that becomes that completely understandable reaction. I noticed a lot when the Queen died, and people can give or take the royal family as much as they want, that's fine, but a lot of people, and I know people who are like this, who had lost people, particularly during the pandemic, were absolutely like devastated by it. They'd never like been down to Buckingham Palace to see her or anything like that, but it was when the Queen died, as a nation, we were almost given permission to grieve. We were actually told, here's 11 days where there's going to be ceremonies and there's going to be moments and you can pay your respects. And actually, a lot of people, you know, you mentioned your dad's situation there, had gone through a period in that last 2 to 3 years where they never got any of that. You know, there was none of that emotional experience. But actually, when the Queen died, I think a lot of that came out because people suddenly went, oh, now I've got permission to grieve. That literally the TV's been switched off. You know, the radios are playing songs, sad songs. You know what I mean? All of those things kicked in that we don't get when we know somebody dies. You get the afternoon off, then you get the day off to go to the funeral, and then you crack on because that's what the system is. Whereas actually sometimes you get those moments where something means so much more, and that's, I think, I guess, where the emotional hit can come.
Yeah, I think with the Queen as well, like obviously her funeral everybody was able to attend it, but she went through a little bit of the same trauma as us in terms of when a husband died, didn't she? They would only allow 30 people at the funeral, and that was a big thing for us as well, you know, as a family. That really hurt. It was upsetting for us, you know what I mean? And it must have been upsetting for friends and family who couldn't actually be in the service. And like you said, it was crazy time during COVID and things like that, because you weren't able to actually go and see your family and things like that, and obviously share that grief. I think one of the ways, obviously, that, by the way, I still suffer from the grief, but I think is to share memories with close friends and family, isn't it? And things like that. And if you don't have that opportunity, and that's what obviously the country did do for the Queen, and I think that's what people do need to do. Do you know what I mean? It's just it's the way of life, really, unfortunately, isn't it? People just try and get on with things. And I remember a friend telling me, actually, who'd lost his brother, quite tragically, very young. He told me, like, the hard bit isn't now, straight after your dad's died, because people will be around you and looking after you and things like that. It's as time goes by, people forget, and they forget, like, to check in on you and things like that. And that's completely normal. Like, people shouldn't just be thinking, oh, I've got to worry about him, I've got to go and check on him and things like that. But it does, and that's why it does get harder over time, I think, for some people. And that's what we need to, like, realize, I think, sometimes.
Yeah, I think it's what it's interesting, isn't it? Particularly when it's fathers, grandfathers. We mentioned the Queen as well, but like people have roles, don't they, within sort of family groups and that. And I think that's the thing with generationally, there comes a point where, and you'll have noticed this with the age you're at, and obviously you work in a school as well. You realize that you're becoming those older roles where you've always looked up to someone. There's always been someone ahead of you, and then you suddenly realize that you're finding yourself in those positions of authority, and then people are looking up to you. So actually your relationship with them changes. And of course, then we've got to get our heads around that, because it's how our position in society, if you like, is moving. And we've got to sort of keep up to date with that. Otherwise, we'll always be, 14 years of age, even into our 80s, where people are looking at us a little bit different. There's so much more in the book, things about football ownership in the book, the ownership situation. The Glazers get a couple of mentions as well. So there's plenty across it, for all football fans from different walks of life. The book's called Football Anything. Now, the in between is a symbol, which is the, let me get this right, greater than symbol. Is that right?
Yeah,
So it's
that's
the
right.
two little lines that sort of point towards it, make it look like an arrow.
Exactly.
But just explain what it means. The
Yeah, there's the little symbol.
there we go.
So the way it would probably be described to a younger child, maybe year one, but we're not technically allowed to describe this anymore. They describe them as crocodiles. So the crocodile eats the bigger amount. So the book is called Football is Greater Than Anything, is what the symbol means. I tried to get a little bit of my maths teaching in there, to link it back to what I do as a job. But to be fair, I'm starting to think I shouldn't have now, because every time someone goes to type it into the book, they're like, type it in on Amazon to find the book. They're like, I can't find this Football is Greater Than Anything book. And I'm just like, just type Football Anything book and just type Football Anything, because to be fair, people forget stuff that they've learned in school, don't they? So yeah, and it is called Football is Greater Than Anything, a bit like, obviously, a bit sarcastic, really, because it then goes about showing that football isn't greater than anything, and using quotes from, like, people like Bill Shankly, for example, that football's more important than life and death. But obviously I try and take that away, that it isn't more important than life and death. But yeah, so like you mentioned as well, with the ownership and things, and I go into a whole aspect of greed as well. So ownership, gambling, and also like how football's actually governed. And I think that's come out in the news recently about obviously the Champions League final, which was governed terribly. So it looks at like the greed side of that. And that's not just looking then at individual players, it's looking at how it affects like a society's mental health, but also how it affects like if certain fans' mental health, so like football clubs that no longer exist, like Bury Town, for example, and things like that. And I think the governance one's quite important, some of the points I'm making that. And I've actually given the book recently to Andy Burnham and Steve Rotherham. They visited Sean's place, and Andy Burnham gets a good mention because he's doing a lot to try and get money back into society so that people are going out and playing football, like you said before, like meeting up and playing five a side. And people are getting priced out of that nowadays. You look at like a pitch hire, it's like £70. It's just crazy. And there's no facilities really. Like, we've got one local to me recently just being built on the old civil service site, in Thornton, sorry. But if you look at other parts of the country, like there's like, I think it's 50 local councils don't have a 3G pitch in their local council.
And
And if you
that idea of football is greater than anything, because we go, oh, it's our national sport, it's the greatest thing ever, we all love it and we all support our team. And then you can go, but actually, if you want to play it when you're a kid, it's keep off the grass or it's pay 70 quid, and all those sorts of things kick in as well, which I think is a testament to where the game's at. So there's plenty more to explore around that. The Bill Shankly quote, by the way, they say football is a matter of life and death. I assure you, it is much more important than that, which is a really great quote from Bill Shankly. I interviewed, or I was speaking to Ian St. John, sadly no longer with us, but an absolute Liverpool legend. And I said, what was he like when he was dishing out these quotes? And he said, oh, he used to laugh his head off. He said he would pick these quotes and then he would joke about them. There was another one, if Everton were playing outside my back door, I'd close the curtains, which is a really great quote as well. But testament to the fact that actually that sense of humour, which was designed to sort of raise some of those issues that you've raised within the game, were taken to be a sort of Bible, if you like. And people still use them and quote them incorrectly, probably to this day. Chris, we're going to wrap it up at that point. Thank you so much for your time. The book is available now. Football Anything. Now, you can buy it online with the traditional online retailer that you're probably all aware of. But also, if you're based in the Merseyside region, head over to the Pritchard's Bookshop in Crosby. That's Pritchard's in Crosby. And you can pick up your copy of Football is Greater Than Anything. But if you just type in Football Anything, you'll get the book from Chris Roberts. Thank you so much for your time. And thanks for joining us on this week's Mental Health Monday.
I hope you've enjoyed this week's podcast. Thanks for checking out Mental Health Monday. My name is Mick Coyle. You can find me on Twitter at Mr. Mick Coyle. You can also find me, Mick Coyle, on Facebook as well. Don't forget, if you want to speak to somebody about your mental health, you can do so. The Samaritans, free to call on 116 123. You can find mental health services where you are. Just look for the Hub of Hope. Type in your postcode. It'll find those mental health services close to you. And for support in a crisis, you can text SHOUT to 85258. That's if you're experiencing a personal crisis, you're unable to cope and need support. Shout to 85258. That's a text line. Do get involved in those services. In an absolute emergency, always remember the number to call is 999. Thanks for downloading the podcast this week. We'll be back next week with more Mental Health Monday.